the last time that we met and talked about C.S. Lewis and mere Christianity, we had talked about, if my notes are correct, about sexual morality, Christian marriage, and started talking a little bit about forgiveness, getting ready to go to the great sin. Well, the great sin is on 121. Forgiveness is 115. But we had just started mentioning forgiveness, which we find, of course, we're to love our neighbor as ourselves. Of course, I said if we don't love ourselves, our neighbor's in trouble. Or depending on how we love ourselves, our neighbor may be in trouble. But as Lewis indicates, our neighbor is not just people who we like or who are like us or had the good taste to like us first. But our neighbor includes even our enemies, which is the really hard part. And in fact, he says early in this chapter, beginning of chapter, one of the most terrible duties of Christianity is forgiving, especially forgiving our enemies. But he goes on to say, I didn't make this up. I'm not the one telling you. I'm not the one that made. I'm telling what Christianity is. Not necessarily what I do. What I should do, yes, but Lewis admits he doesn't always. But then again, seems to me if there was some guy that wrote a bunch of things in the Bible that talked about the things that he wanted to do, he didn't do, and the things he didn't want to do, he ended up doing. The Apostle Paul did that. But he talks about this, Lewis does, and said that's one of the most terrible duties. Why? Because, quite frankly, if our neighbor or our enemy wrongs us, what do we want? Revenge, vengeance, justice, or what we think of as justice. And yet, if we really think about it, if God gave us what we deserve, we'd all be in big time trouble. I know then the folks argue and say, well, but I'm not God, and I'm not Jesus. No, but we're to strive for that, because that's the example which was set. And as we said this morning, Jesus even said, Father, forgive them, as they had driven nails into his wrists and through his feet and had beaten him and were mocking him, etc. And so he said, you know, this is what Christianity is. It's not always what we do, but it's what we're to strive to do. And Lewis, he talks about this straw-splitting distinction of hating what a person did but not hating the person. You know, y'all have heard that, right? Got to love the sinner but hate the sin, and God loves the sinner but hates the sin, and so you got to love your enemy but hate what he does if he wrongs you. And he said, you know, that seems oftentimes to be kind of, he calls it straw splitting, or we'd say splitting hairs in some ways, because how easy is that to do, and how difficult, and what does it really mean to do that? Lewis says it means to be sorry that that person did such a thing, and to be hopeful that they can be cured of what they've done wrong, and to pray for them to be cured of what they've done wrong. And that's one of the steps in forgiving enemies and loving others as ourselves. And that's one of the, that's the first step in this hair splitting of hating the sin but not hating the person. Although it's very often difficult to separate when someone wrongs us. It's tough to separate that out now, isn't it? Oh, it is for me. Maybe not for y'all, but it's very difficult for me. But he says, just as I do things wrong and hate that I do them and wish that I could be healed from them and not do them again, he said, if I wish that for myself when I do things wrong and don't like myself, because you ever tried to kick yourself? Sometimes that's difficult. There was a time in years past where I actually could get my foot up high enough, but I'm not that flexible anymore. But you ever figuratively kicked yourself because of something you've done wrong, and you hated that you did it, and you said, God, please forgive me, I won't ever do it again. I know nobody in here would be one of those that goes up and says, God, please forgive me, I won't ever do it again, and then as you turn, says, oh, but you know, I might do it again next weekend, so get ready to forgive me again. Lewis says, you know, just as we wish we had not done it and we wish that we would improve and do good and God would forgive us. So he said, forgiving our enemies means that we wish them good and healing from what they've done wrong and from the tendency to do what is wrong. Which I think is an interesting way. How often do we think of it that way? You know, when we think of forgiving others, we think of putting it all aside and, okay, treating them like they never did anything wrong. But that's not what Lewis says in this chapter. He said forgiveness in taking that step and really loving people as we love ourselves in forgiveness means not necessarily that we say, oh, they didn't do it, they're okay, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, we're all okay, kind of thing. But recognizing they did wrong and not putting ourselves in a position where they do the wrong to us again. But at the same time, we should wish good for them and wish healing for them, because only when they find that healing can they find forgiveness and find a different way to go about living their lives and possibly not doing that sin again. Of course, that doesn't mean that we have the ability to force them to do that, but we pray for that for them. And that's a part of our healing, is to praying that they will be healed of the sin and will not do it anymore, and that they will come to dislike what they do so much that they wish good not only on themselves, but then they wish to pass that on to others. We punish ourselves with our consciences, but then we come back to that point where we might hate what we do, but we seek to be healed of what we do. So forgiveness doesn't mean letting them off the hook completely. It means wishing for healing for that person, which is different from letting them off the hook. Wishing for healing. And he says that is where forgiveness really can potentially work on someone else. But let them know what they did was wrong. We'll say, I'm praying for your healing and that you'll cease to do this. And when we get to the point where we can begin feeling that we really want them to be healed, then guess who else can be healed? That's right, we can. That's right, Melissa, we can. And like I said this morning, it's nice to stand up here and wish people peace and guidance into peace, and it sounds wonderful, and just follow Jesus, but it's a whole lot harder actually do it. You know, we sometimes throw out these platitudes, but being realistic, it's a lot harder to do. A lot easier to just say something and go on about our business than to actually live it and do it. And that's what he talks about. We need to live that forgiveness or that sense of healing for us and for others. But what's the great sin? Anybody that's read ahead or remembers, what is the great sin? He said earlier, you know, some people might say, oh, great sin, that might be lying, or that might be murder, or that might be sexual sin. All of those are sins, to be sure, and separate us from God. But what does he say is the greatest sin? Pride. That's right, pride. Something that we all have and all have to struggle with is pride or self-conceit. He said it is the utmost evil. Why? He said the devil became the devil because of what? Pride and self-conceit. Oh, I can take over from God. I'm good enough. And if pride caused the devil to become the devil, he calls pride the anti-God state of mind. That is, a state of mind in which we're more important than God. We're more important than someone else. He said if pride caused the devil to become the devil, then what will pride do to us? And not just us, but what will pride then do to relationships? Pride is competitive by nature. Anybody disagree with the idea that pride is competitive? It's competition.
Is it totally always wrong?
If it's
just like,
yeah,
money's not the root of all evil.
It's the love of money, right.
Love of money.
Yeah.
In other words,
it's
the love of pride, in other words.
That's a good question, Ed. And Lewis does address that later in some misunderstandings concerning pride. He said, you know, pleasure in being praised is not pride unless the pleasure of being praised becomes the source to make us feel how fine we are and how much better than everybody else we are. So pride itself, or being proud, is not the sin, but focusing on being proud and focusing on pride to the point where we begin thinking of ourselves superior to others because of that pride that we have. Oh, I'm so much greater than so-and-so. That's where being proud of something or someone then becomes sinful. And it is competitive in nature. We get pleasure out of having or doing more than somebody else, don't we? I do. I told you the other Sunday about my wife. How dare she have the audacity to be talking to somebody when I pulled off a triple play in softball? Yeah. And I still remember that. And she turned and she looked. I saw her turn and looking, and when I came to the sidelines, I said, "Did you see that?" She said, "No, I was talking, but so-and-so said, did you see that?" Where's the instant replay for church softball? I mean, they don't have that stuff. But, you know, it's pride. It is competitive. I have been guilty in the past of saying life is competition. Life is competition. Always trying to do more, to be better, etc. That's why we pay ridiculous sums of money to folks to run around in shorts and bounce a ball, or to hit that little ball and not... Well, some of them still throw the golf clubs in the water, don't they? Bend them around a tree, even when they're making millions and millions of dollars. It is very competitive. And you know, the opposite virtue of pride is what? Right, humility. But it's you got to be careful even there. It has to be a true sense of humility in recognition of who we are compared with God and with others, as opposed to, you know, there are some people you say, well, you know, that person's greatest virtue is their humility. If you don't believe it, just ask them; they'll tell you. Yeah. That's actually pride. That's not humility. But now, Lewis suggests that we can test how proud we are, even religiously. And he talks about how people who are very religious oftentimes are some of the most prideful people around. That guy with the helmet head and the white Nero coat that came in the Bilo Center a few years back when we got tickets to go, given to us, and sat in the Hyatt box, and we were the only ones. And I have to admit, I was proud we were the only ones in the box. I was taking all these people were there. How do we get in? I said, you don't. But y'all are the only one? I said, you don't. But then when he came walking up to "How Great Thou Art" and stood on the stage like this, yeah. Religious pride. I won't mention any names. His initials are Benny Hinn. But he talks about religious people and being prideful, etc. And he says, even religious people, if you want to test how proud you really are, he said, when you feel better than someone else because you are so religious, then you're falling prey to the devil, and you are falling away from true religion into pride, the great sin. What is the real test of being in the presence of God? Lewis says, forgetting self in the service of God and others. He says, seeing self as small. Jesus said that. Jesus said that you're blessed. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of the heavens. In Matthew chapter 5, first beatitude. The idea poor in spirit carries with it the idea that you honestly feel that you never measure up to what is expected of you. You're always falling short. So that makes you work that much harder to try and connect with God, but it's that kind of humility, the poor in spirit, that he's talking about here. G.A. Buttrick, George Arthur Buttrick, New Testament theologian and one of the editors for the old version of the Interpreter's Bible, said in describing a saint, he said, a saint is someone who loses self. in serving God and others. So according to Lewis, the real test of being in the presence of God and of living in the presence of God is forgetting self, considering self less or small, rather than being prideful about that. Always being cognizant of how easy it is to fall and not measure up instead of carrying around the big family Bible with which to smack people over the head on a street corner if you see them doing something you don't agree with. He does talk about misunderstandings. As I said, pleasure in being praised is not pride unless it becomes a source that makes you feel how fine you are and how wonderful you are compared with everyone else. I joke around sometimes and say, the first time I saw Mary, I said, witty, good looking, smart. Yep, I'm the guy for her. Now, but when pride gets to that point, then it becomes a problem. It's simple. Finding pleasure in being praised. Is anybody that doesn't like, you honestly hate it if somebody tells you that you've done a good job? That's not sinful. But when that's all you seek and that becomes the source of your entire identity, then that is sinful and that's pride. He goes on to say another misunderstanding about pride is, you could be proud of your son, proud of your father, proud of your mother, proud of a family member, proud of someone that you've coached. And when it's admiration and it doesn't cause you to get puffed up, that's not sinful. People say, you shouldn't praise so. You shouldn't be proud because your son did that. Or you shouldn't be proud because your spouse did that. You shouldn't admire them. That's not the sin. The sin is when that becomes the reason for being and you get so puffed up, your head gets so swollen you can't get through the door. So finding pride in something that a friend or a family member does and something good that they do, obviously not, I don't think that Dillinger's mom was too proud of some of the things he did. But finding pride in the good things or being proud of that person for the good that they do, as long as it's admiration and not something that causes you to get into a sense of conceit, then it's not a sin. Some people, he says, say that God forbids pride because it offends God. But he says, no. If you are truly humble and get to know God in humility, you know who you are in comparison to God and others, and you are truly humble, then as long as you're not proud of that fact and flaunt it with everybody, look how humble I am, kind of thing. You don't go out on the street corner and stir the ashes and put on sackcloth and sit down and tell people how humble you are. Then it's not sinful when you truly come to understand. It's kind of like, it reminds me of the in Luke chapter 18, the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. They were known as publicans back then, but tax collector. I'm going to say something good about the tax collector. Now, you're the tax assessor. No. You're the Roman. No. But the Pharisee and the tax collector. It was a sense where the Pharisee comes walking in. The text says that the Pharisee and the tax collector came into the temple at the same time. The Pharisee looking down his nose at the tax collector, who shouldn't have been there. And the Pharisee walked right up to the altar, grabbed hold of his suspenders and rocked back and forth and said, God, aren't you glad you got somebody like me? I tithe of everything, even the spices that I give. It's wonderful that you got me, and that I'm not like that old tax collector over there. And Jesus said the tax collector wouldn't even, he did not come in front of the altar, he wouldn't even lift his eyes, and he said, Lord, have mercy on me, because I'm a sinner. And Jesus said, I'm going to tell you, that guy, not the Pharisee, that guy went home with his prayer answered. So we need to be careful not to become Pharisaical about our religion especially. In other words, to be humble, we must not think of ourselves first. Not even to think, boy, I sure am humble. Because that in itself is the opposite. That is pride. The first step to humility is what? This is the tail end of the chapter. But he says the first step to true humility, admitting to yourself that you got pride and you've got conceit. That's like the first step toward recovering from any addiction, is to admit you got a problem. The first step to overcoming the greatest sin is to admit you got a problem. That could almost be on one of those little pull-down shades back there that AA uses on Monday nights, right? I bet it is. So the greatest sin is not murder, although that's horrible. The greatest sin is not sexual misconduct, although that is horrible. The greatest sin, the one from which we all suffer because we're human beings. I mean, right in the story of the man and the woman in the garden. Pride. Wanted to be like God and have the blessings of God. That's where it was. Putting self first. Mm-hmm. And Cain turned out to be Abel. To slay Abel. Yeah. Once again, it was pride. Well, how dare you not take what I offered you? Well, I'll tell you what. Instead of making things right, I'll just kill him and then I'll be the one offering. What are you going to do then? Pride. And then he moves on to charity. Chapter 9. What do we say charity is? And it's not, I mean, most people you say charity, you're thinking somebody with a hand out, right? And giving alms, A-L-M-S. I have a number of times that I've had students write on tests that you're supposed to give alms to people. I'm thinking, okay, there are countries that do that. Our country has done, well, we didn't actually give them, we sold them, but to give alms to the poor. Those who in need. That is a worthy cause. It really is. To help folks who are in need. But that's not the root of charity. C.S. Lewis says, while that's a good thing and that's a noble thing, and as Christians we should, that love in the Christian sense is true charity. And in the Christian sense, he says, not just an emotion. Kumbaya. It's not just an emotion. He says, in the Christian sense, love or charity is a state of will toward others. We will ourselves to honestly help others, not so we can put little ticks on the scorecard with God and earn our stripes or get another star in our crown. Sometimes I think people who really honestly think, boy, I'm going to get another star in my crown. The only star they're going to have in their crown is when they get crowned, they're going to see stars. But to honestly have a state of will toward others which seeks to be charitable, to love them, and to seek the best for them. He goes on, what do you think about his statement that love or charity itself is neither a sin nor a virtue? It's how you use that sense of love or charity that makes it sinful or a virtue. In other words, it's how you live your life, either being loving and charitable or not, or using your charity to get one up on somebody else that can make it sinful or a virtue. In and of itself, it is not a virtue, nor is it a sin. But it is, in other words, it is exercising or living, acting out of love of neighbor. That's true charity. I have often said, and I think, I'm not sure, I may be splitting hairs with C.S. Lewis here. If so, so be it. Maybe someday we'll have a conversation. But I hope that's after I die. Otherwise, I might think he's a bit of undigested beef or something. But it's having a cold temperament a sin. I've often said that actually hating someone, there is a sin in relationship to other people that is worse than hating someone. And that is being apathetic toward them. Having a cold temperament toward them. They don't matter. I mean, if you love somebody, you're going to let them know that they matter and they're worth loving. If you hate somebody, you're going to eventually let them know that you think they're worth hating. But to totally ignore them, that's saying you're not even worth the time to think about. I'm not sure that that's what he means by cold temperament here. But the question comes up when he talks about temperament. Is having a cold temperament a sin? He said no. You know, there are people who are not overly warmed or overjoyed by showing charity and love for others. They seem to be kind of cold in the way that they do things. He says that in itself is not sin. But it is no more sin than having bad digestion is a sin, and does not cut them out from the chance or excuse them from the duty of learning charity. So seeming to not really care as much is not the sin, but what happens is when we become apathetic, he says, then we cut ourselves, where it becomes a sin is we cut ourselves out from learning the responsibility that we're supposed to share charity or love with other people. That's when being kind of nonchalant or cool towards folks or about folks becomes sinful. Just having that kind of temperament is not. If we recognize that we still have to act out of love for neighbor, and we do that on occasion, we're not committing a sin. The sin comes when we make excuses. Are there not enough poor houses? Or when we, once again, Dickens, yeah, you know, but we, since we just came out of Christmas and I saw different versions of A Christmas Carol several times. But that if we get to the point where we don't make excuses about it and we don't use it as a means of not learning charity, then it's our temperament's our temperament. He does talk about, though, the difference in worldly charity and Christian charity. He says worldly charity means that I treat certain people kindly and lovingly and charitably because either I like them or they're like me. We do it because I like them. I do it because they're like me. Or I do it because they were the first one to say, you know, I really like you. So, hey, well, yeah, this is a good person. Good taste. He said, that's worldly. That's the, we're climbing the ladder. You do unto some before they do unto you, but you do unto others so that you can climb the ladder because they can help you along. And believe it or not, there are still people these days who'll choose a church because of business. I know y'all know that, but there are people who've done that for eons. But that's the worldly approach. He says the true Christian approach seeks to treat all kindly, even those that we don't like. Along the way, we may actually come to like them better. Or, along the way, they may actually, because of that, become better. When it comes to charity or not, though, page 132. Good and evil both increase at compound interest. You ever thought of that? Of course, you know, the cynic says no good deed goes unpunished. But good deeds, even small ones, can increase, compound. What was the movie a few years ago? The kid was in it that in the other movie, Bruce Willis, he saw dead people. It's based on a true story. Pay it forward. Okay, Channel 4 and Pay It Forward. But, you know, small things, you know, just the small things that he started and then people started doing for others. There's a commercial amazing how commercials touch our lives, but there's a commercial that's been played in the last several weeks a number of times where somebody's walking along and they see somebody open the car door for somebody else and they think, oh, and then they go along and they do something for somebody else in that scene and they do something for somebody else in that scene. That happens with good things. And it pays compound interest. Small things can add up to larger things. But, on the other hand, the flip side of that coin is bad actions and bad thoughts also pay compound interest. You start off with the small thing, and then it compounds and gets worse, and compounds and gets worse. Your conscience starts bothering you, but you know your conscience is one of the easiest things eventually to beat into oblivion. You can beat your conscience senseless if you really want to. Or rationalize it away. That's right. But we need to remember, he said, when it comes, especially when it comes to charity, that doing good or evil, either one, increase at compound interest. The little things do add up. The little things do add up. And so, in showing that charity, we also come back to putting down our sense of pride and offering a little hope to the world. His chapter on hope, chapter 10, very short. I just want to talk a few minutes about it, and then next time we'll look at faith. And he talks about two different levels of faith in the book, and then we'll move to book 4, Beyond Personality. But Lewis talks about the accomplishments of people. And he talks about hope as being one of the theological virtues on page 134. And he talked earlier about there were different virtues, and some of them were theological virtues. Hope is one of those theological virtues. It means continually looking forward to the eternal world is not, for Christians, and people talk about heaven. Now, I would also state that looking toward heaven should not get to the point where that's all you do is look toward heaven and you forget about earth and what's going on around you. But he said, a lot of folks, and he said he, as an atheist, when he was an atheist before he started his journey and went from atheism to theism then to Christianity, Lewis said, it was escapism, he thought. When Christians talked about heaven and being in heaven and going to heaven, that it was escapism. Pie in the sky, by and by. They're just trying to escape the realities of earth. But he said, really, it's not that for a Christian. Looking forward to the eternal world is not escapism, but it is part of what Christians are expected to do. It's part of what we're expected to do. To look forward to that time when we're fully in God's presence and are fully known. Paul says, now I see through a glass dimly, but then I shall see face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know and be known in the whole. So that's part of it, is looking forward to that and that connection with God that was lost early on in human history. But at the same time, there is that understanding that if we look to heaven, Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father, the one who is in the heavens, let your name be made holy. Let your kingdom come to pass. Let your will come to pass as in heaven also upon earth." Very literally, that's how it reads from the Greek text. As it is in heaven, also upon earth. So while we look toward heaven and God's rule and God's reign and what heaven may be like and the lives we anticipate, even though, metaphor and simile and all of that, the lives we anticipate there should then cause us to work and hope to make the earth more like the heavens. And that's what you're actually praying for in that prayer, is that God will exercise His will, His desire, and God will exercise His kingdom and power on earth just as He does in heaven, so that the earth will become more like the heavens. Lewis does say on page 134, he says, aim at heaven and you'll get earth thrown in. Aim at earth, you'll get neither one. About two-thirds of the way down the page. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they become so ineffective in this. Aim at heaven and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you'll get neither. In other words, if all you're looking for is the worldly part of it, you're not going to get heaven or earth. But if you aim at heaven, that is, aim at living a life that is worthy of heaven and like life should be in heaven, then you get the earth thrown in too. In other words, things can change. Things can become better on earth as well. And so, in doing so, we give that sense of hope, not only for ourselves, but to others, that the earth can become more like the heavens. But at the same time, and while the language, streets of gold and pearly gates and all that kind of stuff, is comforting to many, and if you think about the time in which it was written, you go back and read in the book of Revelation, we talked before in our Revelation study a year or so ago about how about the metaphor and the simile and the allegory that's being used throughout there for the people at that particular point in time, because there are jewels mentioned that, for the most part, what's that? Yeah. And yet, you know, chrysoprase, what's that? Yet for them, it was a precious. If we were writing it today, if John were around and writing it today, he might talk about not just streets of gold, but also platinum and diamonds and rubies and emeralds and all that kind of stuff. What he was saying is to these people who didn't have a whole lot of hope, but they were looking for hope, he was saying that God will vindicate you if you remain loyal to God and where you will be in God's presence. Imagine a city and a world made out of the most precious minerals, the most precious jewels that you can imagine, and that will pale in comparison to being in God's presence. So he said, oftentimes what atheists and agnostics and others will do is poke fun at angels playing harps, and we're going to have wings, and every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings, and all that kind of stuff. I remember that out of the movie. I haven't watched that movie in several years because I watched it so much. Yes, Charlie the Angel. But he said, crowns here on page 137. Crowns are mentioned to suggest the fact that those who are united with God in eternity share His splendor and power and joy. Gold is mentioned to suggest the timelessness of heaven. Gold doesn't rust, and the preciousness of it. People who take these symbols literally might as well think that when Christ told us to be like doves, read it, didn't you? He meant we should lay eggs. So we need to recognize that when we talk about living a life looking toward heaven, those things can inspire us and inspire hope in us, but at the same time, we need to understand that they are metaphors and similes to get us to think about living the very best life that we can in connection with God, so that what happens on earth becomes an extension of God's exercise, of God's desire in and through us on earth. Not our desire, but God's desire. And that in itself, we might lay some eggs when we try to do that, but that in itself can inspire hope in people who have a sense of hopelessness. And in a world in 2011, 2010, 2009, or in AD 69, a world that is in turmoil, that kind of an understanding moving toward living a life which seeks healing not only for ourselves but prays for healing for others, that seeks humility rather than being prideful or proud of the fact that we sure are religious. Boy, our religion is better than that religion, and my church is better than my church is better than this church. My God's better than your God. My God's better than yours. That's one of the things that religions do. They fight over whose God's better. That when we get to the point where we really true charity, even to those who are not like us, or we might not necessarily like, we still hold them accountable. We still hold them accountable. But we pray for their healing. And we pray that they would cease doing the things that they do. And that in itself brings hope to a world that seems to be hopeless. And it's a whole lot easier for me to stand up here and say than it is for me to do sometimes. But as Lewis said, I didn't make the rules, I'm just telling you what they are. God says you will love neighbor as yourself. You will pray for your enemies. And you will seek to do good even to those who harm. You know, sometimes I really like the Bible, sometimes I don't like it. Not seriously. Because it points those fingers at me and says, you know, you're supposed to be doing it this way and you're not doing such a good job. And then the more I dig at it, the more I find out, and that frustrates me even more because, come on. Certainly, if I spend enough years and dig long enough, I'm going to find something that's going to contradict that so that I can feel better about it, and I don't. So we just have to go along and work together. And yes, I'm over 5 minutes, so tell me something new, right? But as you go, may you find that hope, may you find that humility, and may you find that sense of charity which God gives to each, offers to each of us, but then through us offers to others. And may it not be easy. For if it's easy, it's not worthwhile. That's true. People would rather be loved than hated, but rather be hated than ignored. God bless you. Go in peace. Thank you. Amen.